You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And a big thanks to Leslie Marshall, who filled in for me yesterday while I was sitting on an airplane on my way home from Germany. I got a little later on the program, I'm going to tell you all about this. My friend Gerhard, who I've known for, 35 years or thereabouts, he and I have traveled all around the world. He's one of the principals with Salem Internationalists, international Christian nonprofit group that I've volunteered with for since 1978. What is that, 35 plus years, I think? And, you know, we've started programs in Uganda, in South America, in Australia, in Germany, in the United States, and in a bunch of other countries. Anyhow, I had this terrible heart attack. And so I went over to see him, and I got to tell you about how the German healthcare system worked and is working for him. And because I just, you know, my brother-in-law just had a very, very similar heart attack and a very interesting and somewhat different experience here in the United States. So we'll get into that. This question about Hillary Clinton running, does that mean that another woman can't be on the ticket? I want to get into that. The Supreme Court just upheld the affirmative action ban in Michigan. I find this interesting. And the Republicans in the House of Representatives once again are saying, no, the amount of money that the Centers for Disease Control can have to study the impact of gun violence, even though it kills about as many people as heart attacks in the United States, and cancer, you can't study this. I don't get this. But maybe Bill Frady does. He's the host of the Lock and Load radio show presented by the Gun Owners of America. Gunowners.org is the website. Hey, Bill, welcome to the program.
Well, hello, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. Why would you, I don't mean you in the personal sense, but y'all, yeah, you know, the NRA, in general, why would you not want our public health agencies to investigate the public health consequences of guns? We might find something really useful that could save some lives.
Well, I myself am not against it. And I'm not against the CDC doing it, because they did it last year.
Okay.
That was either executive action 16 or 17 on President Obama's 23 executive actions that...
What'd they learn?
Well, and let me preface it by saying this. I'm willing to go where the data leads, okay?
Yeah.
I'm willing to go where the data leads. Now, this was the CDC report, Priorities for Research to Reduce the Threat of Firearm-Related Violence, excuse me.
Right.
And it was released in June of 2013.
Okay.
Item number one... And it's up and published if you want to go check it out. You don't have to take my word for it.
Sure.
Item number one, armed citizens are less likely to be injured by an attacker.
Makes a certain amount of sense. Not a lot of armed citizens around there, but that makes a certain amount of sense. What about, in a home with a gun where there is a history of domestic abuse, the probability of murder is 500% greater?
Well, for some reason, they do not address that.
Okay. What about the suicide rates in homes with guns being dramatically higher?
The only time they address suicide in it is that the overwhelming majority of gun deaths are suicides.
Right. And that's
they did not for some reason, and I'm sure it's a mystery to me, as it is probably a mystery to you. They did not get into the They did not. The only thing they got into as far as looking at trends, as far as that goes, is accidental death, which they say is declining. But as far as suicide is concerned, they didn't get out there and try to make any sort of correlation between guns being there or not.
Right. Let me just ask a question, one guy to another here.
Sure.
I've been around guns since I was a little kid. My mom was a pretty good shot. And, when I was 6 or 7 years old, I got a BB gun. I had cap guns. I never had an actual gun. But my brother, one of my three brothers, is very into guns. He lives out in rural Michigan, and he's got a shooting range in his backyard. He and his wife both. And between the two of them, I think they own 7 or 8 guns, handguns. And when Louise and I go to Michigan, we get together, Steve and Tam, and sometimes, you know, some of my other brothers, and we'll either go to the gun range in Michigan or we'll go up to Steve's house and we'll do competitive shooting. We've been doing this for years. I got, you know, none of us are hunters. I mean, people around us are. And if they're going to eat what they kill, I don't have a problem with it. But what I don't get is all the hysteria. I don't get the fetishizing, these guys who feel the need to show up, you know, with a gun on their hip and show that they're men. Are they compensating for small penises? I mean, I don't get it. What's the deal? I know a lot of these guys, you know, and a lot of them, most of the guys in fact, you know, when I was a teenager, I grew up in Michigan and I knew some of the Michigan militia guys, and sure, some of them are, you know, just decent patriotic guys, but some of them are just over the top and they seem to be the ones who get all the PR. What's going on?
Well, maybe I'm one of those guys. I have a lot of guns. I carry a gun every day.
But do you walk around where it's visible?
No.
I mean, Tam walks and carries a gun in her purse every day. I mean, you know, she lives out in the rural area and she's out and she works in a vet clinic. She comes home late at night. I mean, she wouldn't wear a strap down her hip.
Well, in my state, I can't. In states, you can.
Yeah, and, but if you could, would you?
Well, I'm sort of on the fence about that one. I don't want to alarm my fellow citizen that may not be their cup of tea.
Yeah, I mean, who wants to walk into a Starbucks and see a guy with a gun in front of him? I mean, it's a little intimidating.
The only problem I have with that, Tom, is that if I add a badge to the equation, it's okay.
Well, even then, if I walk into a Starbucks and there's a cop with a gun sitting there, I'm looking at that going, I remember, this is maybe a year or so ago, I was standing behind three people behind a police officer in a line in a grocery store, and some kid reaches up and grabs the butt of this guy's gun. Now, he was fast. He put his hand on that thing so fast, and of course it was clipped in. You know, the kid couldn't get it out.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is that if it was a determined person who knew how to pop a clip and pull a gun, it could have been a very messy situation. I just don't, you know, yeah, we, you know, it's a necessary evil. Our police have to be armed. Although, you know, for a long, long time in England, for example, they weren't. But that doesn't mean that you and me, that we need to, at least in a way where it's visible and accessible.
Well, see, here's the deal. I train for self-defense. Having said that, I never want to use it.
Yeah,
I never want to use it. However, anything that I can do that will deter a crime to where I don't have to make that choice. And if I'm forced to make that choice, I will make it, and it'll be something that I have to live with for the rest of my life. But if I have to make that choice, I will do it. But any little thing that I can add to the equation to keep that crime from happening to me and mine.
Yeah, but it's not that dangerous a society we live in, Bill. I mean, I was in the middle of a war zone in Uganda. I didn't carry a gun. Yeah, I got shot at, or people shooting all around me. But, you know, carrying a gun, I'm telling you, in really dangerous societies, I've been in Darfur, I've been in South Somalia, or South Sudan, I've been in Uganda during the war. I was in Egypt when the week that Sadat went down and there were guns everywhere. You carry a gun, you're increasing the risk you're going to get shot.
Not necessarily. I mean, in my state, I live in South Carolina. For the first time in a long time, South Carolina is being probed by the gang.
Yeah.
And we just experienced a spike in violence. South Carolina's fifth most dangerous state.
Right, but it's gang members killing gang members. They're not killing people like you.
Well, they shoot. We've got one in College Town, Columbia, South Carolina. They like to hang out with them.
Hang on.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Bill, I got to wrap it up, but I appreciate the reasonable conversation. Thanks for dropping by.
As do I, Tom. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Bill Frady. It's gunowners.org is the website. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Nate Sweet, international superstar of the small screen. Hey, Nate, how you doing?
Very small screen.
Well, no. You're a TV star. You're not just a YouTube star, although you're that, too. So, tonight, in fact, you're going to be on TV with us tonight.
I am. I will. So, for tonight's show, we'll have Tony Juniper from the – Hold on one second. From the Prince of Wales International Sustainability Society.
This is Prince Charles's right-hand guy.
Yeah. He's going to be on. We're going to be talking about, you know, it's Earth Day today, so we'll be talking about that, and we'll also be talking about some of the recent, you know, tipping points we've reached in the climate. This month is actually going to be the first month in human history that we are totally over 400 parts per million in carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere. So we'll look at sort of the solutions and what we should have, what we should be thinking about on this Earth Day in terms of how we relate to the natural world.
And how it relates to us.
Exactly.
Rather dispassionately, I would add.
Yeah, we're inextricably linked to the natural world, and the natural world is linked to us. So some big picture stuff there. And then in B and C, in second block, and the third block, we'll have our politics panel for that. We'll be talking about how the American middle class is not the wealthiest middle class in the world anymore. That honor is now held by our friends, our neighbors to the north, the Canadians. We'll be talking about how the GOP refuses to fund CDC gun research at the Center for Disease Control. That center has zero funding for gun violence research, which is pretty shocking. It's pretty much all the result of NRA lobbying. We were also talking about former Chief Supreme Court Justice John Stevens recently came out against the court's decision in the McCutcheon versus FEC case. We'll be talking about that. He actually supports a constitutional amendment to take money out of politics, which is pretty impressive.
You know, Stevens was the one, and you might want to dig this out, in his dissent in Citizens United, there's about four really eloquent sentences in there. In fact, I think we used it we made a graph out of it last week or the week before, where he said, if this decision stands, if we allow all this money into politics, people aren't going to trust the political process anymore, and they're going to stop participating. And that's the death of democracy.
Yeah, and apparently nobody listened to him.
Yeah.
Four years down the road, we're making
He was prescient. Thing. I mean, in 2010? That was 4 years ago. Yeah. He was prescient.
An interesting guy, and we'll also be touching on some of his opinions on this, on the Second Amendment as well.
Yeah. I would love to get him on for an interview.
Yeah,
Sean, if you're listening.
Yeah, I think that would be great. I think I actually brought that up. I think I sent an email around about that.
Yeah.
He seems like a really cool guy. We'll also be talking about the administration's decision to put off the Keystone XL pipeline decision until after the midterms. And then we'll be talking about the ongoing Bundy Ranch controversy and really trying to ask the conservatives what exactly they see in this guy, because it's pretty hard. It's pretty hard to see.
I wish I'd asked Bill Frady about that. You know, all these guys showing up, starting around with guns at the Bundy Ranch. You know, what's that about? You know.
Yeah, I don't really get it.
Yeah.
Of all the things to be outraged about, the government does. This is.
I get it as
on my priority list.
You know,
I think.
People, 34 years of Reaganomics have screwed the working class in this country, and they're pissed off, pardon the phrase, and they're not sure where to direct it, and so why not direct it at the government? Isn't the government supposed to help us? Isn't the government supposed to defend us? Which is an interesting predicate for the Tea Party to bounce off against without acknowledging. You know, it's like circular logic. Anyhow, Nate Sweet, I will see you on the television tonight.
Will do.
Thanks,
right,
Nate.
Bye.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the weapons of mass deception. I found this article absolutely fascinating. Jennifer Steinour, writing in today's New York Times, the political memo section. I don't know where that is in the paper, but on the little thing I read on my phone, it was one of the more passed around. Few doubt that Hillary Rodham Clinton's nomination for president would be good for women, but her candidacy would also likely block the paths for other women running for the White House, and notably for those who would like to be vice president. Those are the first two sentences of this article. And, you know, she goes on to quote a bunch of, you know, the conventional wisdom. You know, she even quotes Bob Schrum in here. You know, the one guy who has advised, what, five failing campaigns? Anyhow, but I agree with Bob Schrum. He says, so why can't we have two women? The only people who would rebel against that wouldn't vote for Hillary Clinton anyway. I think he's right. He says, for two centuries, we've only had men on the ticket. Well, that's not altogether true. You had Geraldine Ferraro, on the Democratic side, and you had Sarah Palin on the Republican side. So, you know, we have had female vice presidential nominees. But if Hillary Clinton is the nominee in 2016, and there's, you know, barring circumstances in her life, you know, if she were to get sick or something, God forbid, you know, I mean, you know, barring personal circumstances, you know, they're putting together Hillary committees. I mean, they're doing all the stuff, and they don't do this if she doesn't say, if she says no, they don't do it. Let me rephrase that. So I think it's a pretty solid thing that she's going to run. But what if she picked Elizabeth Warren as her VP? I'd work my butt off for that. You know, if it was another DLC Dem, I mean, it's still more important than a Republican. Look at the damage that the Supreme Court is doing right now, because there are five people on the Supreme Court who were nominated by George W. Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, and Ronald Reagan. The White House, even if the president's a schmuck, if they're at least a Democrat and capable of nominating somebody to the Supreme Court of some consequence. And there's no doubt in my mind that between now and 2020, which would be the end of the first term of whoever the next president is, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is going to be gone from the court, and maybe sooner than later. I mean, I'm just looking at age and health. Kennedy, who is the swing vote, he's in his mid to late 70s, I think 76, 78, something like that. Scalia's in his 70s. You've got, a number of, I mean, there's some substantial changes. But, you know, all that said, and I'm not trying to build a case for Hillary here as much as I am acknowledging the political reality and questioning the political wisdom, the conventional wisdom, that you can't have two women on a ticket. California has two women as senators, Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer. Nobody's going, too many. New Hampshire has two women as senators. The one's a Republican. I'm not sure if that counts, but, well, yeah, of course it counts. Go on. It's a bad joke. So what do you think? Is it possible? I don't get it. Did I talk last week about this brain resilience mechanism? I don't think I did. I think we were going to talk about this on Tuesday today. Oh, I know. I was going to tell you about my friend Gerhard. He's in this meeting. He suddenly feels like he's going to be sick. He goes to the bathroom to barf. He breaks out into a sweat. Suddenly his left arm just goes numb. This guy's having a heart attack. He sort of puts two and two together, goes out, gets in his car and starts driving toward home, sees a sign for a hospital, pulls over, pulls in, and they say, okay, you are having a serious heart attack. He had something like, 100% blockage in a couple of coronary arteries. He had done some serious damage. So they popped in stents. They did the whole balloon thing and the stent thing. Now, when this happened to my brother-in-law, they cut him open and they replaced five arteries. The same thing with my dad. But with Gerhard, they put the stents in, and then after that, he was in the hospital for 2 weeks. They let him go home for a couple of days, and now he's in this place called, the town is called Bad Kissingen. It's where I'd spent all day Saturday and half a day Sunday. Got there Friday night. I flew over Friday, actually I got there Saturday night, excuse me. I flew over, after halfway through my TV show, I hopped off, got on the plane at a 10 o'clock flight, went to Germany, went to Frankfurt, took the 4-hour train over there, spent all day Saturday and then Sunday morning with Gerhard and came back. So Bad Kissingen, Bad means bath. Back 300, 400, 500 years ago, actually 800 years ago, this is how old the city is, they're famous for their hot water, their saline baths. People go there for health. And so there's all these health clinics. And he's at this clinic where they're working with him on his diet, on his exercise. He's got to stay there 5 weeks. All expenses paid. Super good. He's on a vegan diet. They do let him have a glass of red wine at night. In fact, he and I had a couple. And it's like their attitude toward this is, we are going to get you well. We're going to help you change your lifestyle. Why don't we do this in America? I mean, Germany has more or less a national healthcare system, although they have significantly semi-privatized it since I was there in the 80s. It used to be single payer. And now he actually has an insurance company, but, you know, his employer pays most of it. But it's just like this very, very rational process. Why don't we do this here?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Oh, and of course, he's got a couple of months off from work. Paid. Paid. Well, they have paid maternity leave there, too. 28 minutes before the hour. By the way, happy Earth Day. As I recall, it was a much bigger deal back in the 70s. Of course, then it was kind of in our face. I mean, you had acid rain coming out of the skies. You had the Cuyahoga River catching on fire. You had, you know, you could see the air in the cities. It was in our face. Now it's not so in our face, at least if you don't live in China. It's kind of invisible, but it's until Superstorm Sandy hits you. And then there's a whole, you know, paid industry out there going, it's gotten in. Don't pull back that curtain. Don't look at that man behind the curtain. But Earth Day, I think, is a pretty big deal. Tonight on TV, I'm going to talk with Prince Charles's right-hand man, who's in charge of his whole environmental thing. That should be interesting. The other thing I did, and I will get to your, I see our board is full of calls here. I will get to your call. Falls in just a moment. The other thing I did on this trip is I read a large chunks of Thomas Piketty's. Yeah, it's the French pronunciation, not the. It looks like it should be Piketty, but it's Piketty or Piketty anyway. So that's how it's pronounced. New book about capital, and it's sort of our generation's version of Das Kapital. Only he trashes Marx pretty good, too. This is no Marxist tome. But here, let me boil the entire book down. And this is not to say you shouldn't buy it and read it, because I think you should. And we're trying to get him on as a guest, in fact. But, I think that in terms of analysis, his analysis is absolutely brilliant. And you can boil it down to a very, very simple thing. If you look at the history of capital, now capital is wealth. It's not income. The paycheck you get at the end of the week is not capital unless you, as long as you're spending, it's not capital, it's wealth. It's not capital or wealth, it's income. Right? It's just money. If you buy land with it, if you buy gold with it, if you buy, anything that's negotiable, presumably, if you buy stocks and bonds with it, if you put it in a banking account, then it becomes wealth. You with me so far? Now, there are, the vast majority of us, and I count myself among this category, my total income last year from money as a capitalist was probably a little over $1,000. I'm a lousy capitalist, lousy investor. In fact, I might have even lost money last year. Maybe that was the year before last. But I do get a paycheck. So I'm not a capitalist. I'm an entrepreneur. I mean, I get a paycheck from a company that I own. But that doesn't make me a capitalist. That makes me an entrepreneur. There's a difference. With me so far? Okay. So I don't earn my income from wealth. I don't make my living from money. I make my living by talking on the radio to you or the television and by talking on the television at night and by writing books. Every 3 or 4 months, I get a check in the mail from, they all go through my agent. So, from various publishers for royalties for various books that I've written over the years. And thank God for that. I mean, you know, we put a couple kids through college with the money from my writing. But the fact of the matter is that I am, by definition, part of the working class, not part of the capital class, because I earn all of my living from the sweat of my brow, right, from the work of my brain and my body. Now, there are other people, you know, the kind of Mitt Romney, Paris Hiltons of the world, Warren Buffetts of the world, who earn their money using money. They invest money, and that money produces a return. Those people are called capitalists. They make their money off capital rather than off labor. I mean, there's somebody else's labor involved, but they're making their money off capital. And they're a relatively small percentage of our national, you know, of us. They are, you know, certainly fewer than 3 million people because they're fewer than the 1%. It's a fraction of the 1% who make their money exclusively through money rather than drawing a salary. So what Piketty says in his book is basically that wealth has always produced a return of between 5 and 8%, typically 7 to 8% year after year after year, going all the way back 1,000 years. When you invest wealth, you make a good, steady return. Even when the market crashes, yeah, there are times when there are hiccups, but then when the market crashes, you have these incredible buying opportunities, and so your wealth, you know, massively increases in future years. But on average, wealth, capital, the return on capital is around 7 or 8%. Whereas the return on income, labor, is typically whatever GDP is. So if GDP grows by 1.5%, then typically wages grow by 1.5%. You don't become wealthier necessarily. You might become a little richer, but you might have a little more money to spend. But unless you're setting that money aside or you're investing it, you're not a capitalist, right? Now, if capital grows at 7% and income grows at 1%, that means over time, I mean, like as in over a century or two, the people who started out with capital, and most capital is acquired through inheritance, by the way, the people who started out with capital over multiple generations are going to end up with massively more capital. I mean, 7% return, that means every 5-6 years you double your money. Whereas the people who earn their money through labor, their wealth, the money they have in the bank, never doubles. It might go up a little bit if they're really good at saving, and they can slowly transition themselves into the capitalist class, but you've got to have a hell of a good income to do that. You've got to be like, you know, Stephen Jay Hemsley and be the CEO of a United Healthcare, of a health insurance company, make $1 billion. Then you can become a capitalist. Now, given these two facts, capital increases, you know, capital returns are 500-700% greater than income returns. Why the hell is it that if you work like I do, you pay a maximum 39% income tax? But if you make your living off money like Mitt Romney does, you have a completely separate tax category. It's called capital gains, and you pay a maximum of 20% income tax. Now, the way that the rich people sold us average suckers on supporting, you know, Reagan, and not just, I mean, this has been for years, on supporting a lower capital gains tax than an earned income tax, is by saying that capitalists are putting money at risk, and therefore they deserve a tax break for that. Well, hell, if you're putting money at risk, you're doing so because you're going to get a return. And in fact, the greater the risk, the greater the return. Why should you get a better tax deal? So what Piketty argues, I mean, he ends up the book, you know, arguing for a national wealth tax, an international wealth tax. Take money away from those people who have, you know, more than $10 million. Some small amount, he talks about 1.5%. and give it to people who earn, who have no wealth. The bottom 50% of America owns nothing. They're in debt. The top 1% owns half of everything. The top 10% owns 70% of everything, as if I'm remembering my numbers correctly. So take away 1.5% every year and move that down to the bottom, and you'll have a more equal society, and that'll be a good thing. It'll be good for democracy. It'll be good for the economy. It'll be good for the people. Now, I don't know if, like I said, I didn't read the entire book. It's like 700 pages. I skipped through it at some considerable, although I had, 20 hours to read on airplanes and sitting around waiting for Gerhardt to get out of the doctor's office. And so I didn't see a specific policy prescription for the United States, but it seems to me like one really common sense thing that we should do right now, tomorrow, today, is we should be saying very loudly to the political class, why is it that the brain surgeon, the entrepreneur, you know, the business, the small business owner, the, you know, whatever, fill in the blank, somebody who's making, you know, enough money that they've got to pay into that top tax rate, you know, over 100 grand or 150 or whatever. I don't know where the tax thresholds are, but why is it that somebody who earns a living by their work has to pay 39% and somebody who earns a living sitting on their butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive pays a maximum 20% income tax? Shouldn't we reverse those? Shouldn't, or else just do away with the capital gains idea altogether and just say all income is ordinary income, period. But I think if we reversed them, it would be a great thing for this country. So that, you know, Mitt Romney pays a maximum 29% of his income tax, and I pay a maximum 20% because I'm working my butt off out here. And he's sitting in one of his seven mansions waiting for the dividend check to arrive. Oh, and his son the other day, wasn't that precious? His son the other day taking a picture of Mitt paying his taxes, going, nah, 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 his son who has $10 million in a trust fund.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And as I said, and as Piketty points out in his book, that's how most wealth is acquired. It's like, you know, the Koch brothers, they inherited millions from daddy, just like Donald Trump did. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's pick up some phone calls here. I've been talking too much. Jared in Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Jared, what's on your mind? Jared, you are listening to your TV and not your telephone. You got to listen to the telephone. Corky in Hilton, New York, you are on the air. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's up?
Hello, Tom.
Hey.
Yeah, I tell you, I was listening to Bundy Ranch deal. I didn't believe, you know, those guys were going to put their women out front until I heard Jon Stewart last night. They played a clip.
Yeah.
And he was saying, yeah, they had the women out front because they wanted America to see the soldiers shooting their women.
Right.
What kind of men are these?
I know.
Where did you get your cojones?
I know.
You don't put your wife out there and hide behind her skirt.
Well, apparently they did.
And
here's what's really interesting. By the way, you know, this guy's been saying this land's been in his family since 1877 or something like that. Turns out he bought this ranch in 1948. And or his father bought it in 48. He was born in 42. And the BLM was created back in the 30s, if I've got my timeline right. And so anyhow, he bought the land, he bought the ranch, and he bought the water rights, but he didn't buy the rights to the BLM land around it. And so he doesn't have this long history. I mean, you know, it's like everything about this guy is a lie. And still Fox News and Hannity are going with it because, you know, he's a white guy on a horse with a Stetson hat.
Well, that's, you know, that's all court stuff. That doesn't bother me. What bothers me is when these big, brave men out there with their guns are willing to put their women up front.
Yeah.
That's what bothers me.
Yeah.
If they're going to be the second line of protection in this country,
we're
in serious trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't disagree at all. Corky, thanks a lot for the call. Karem in Arlington, Texas, or is it Karen?
It's Kareem.
Kareem. Uh-huh. Thank you.
How you doing?
Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. I'm well. How are you?
Good. I was just calling on the first topic that you touched upon with of course, the issue of guns.
Right.
I'm a retired New York City detective. I live here in Arlington, Texas now, but it angers me that people think that carrying a gun will easily protect them from the bumper sticker term of bad guy. When, if that was the case, then there would be no police officers killed in the line of duty or things of that nature. People understand that once you're armed, out and carried and concealed, if somebody got the drop on you, you're done. You're a goner. They're going to rob you. They're going to take what they want. There's nothing you can do to pull your gun and protect yourself at that point.
Right.
Unless you're going to shoot the person as they're running away.
Yep.
And that's the only other option you have. People are surprised when I tell them that my 20 years as a detective in New York City, I didn't carry my gun off duty. They're surprised by that because I realized that being a cop, crime is so random. Even if you're in a high crime area, it's so random that it may not happen to you. There's a high chance that it's not going to happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you realize that criminals are predators. They prey on people who they think are vulnerable. I'm a big guy, so I know the likelihood. I'm not saying it's not going to happen. The likelihood of me being a victim of a crime is very low.
Yeah.
Unless I get caught in a crossfire and somebody's just shooting randomly. Other than that, the chance of me being a crime victim is very low. So it just angers me that people look at it and say that I'm a big guy, I'm going to carry a gun, and that's going to protect me and I'll be able to kill the bad guy. It doesn't work.
I think they watch too many John Wayne movies. You know, these guys, they're living in a fantasy world. I tell you, I live here in D.C., and I've walked through some fairly dicey neighborhoods and at strange periods of time, and it seems to me like the people are more afraid of me, frankly, than I am of them. Kareem, thank you very much for the call. Thanks for your service to your city. We'll be back. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Harbin here with you, helping you win the water cooler wars. Yeah, sounds like a fine plan. Vernon in Twin Cities, Minnesota, listening on AM 950. Hey, Vernon, you have some questions about Ronald Reagan.
Yes, Vernon Berkness, I had 5 questions here. First time caller, you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
Reagan started in with giving the breaks to the wealthy, and I was wondering what book is there to read that tells a lot about this, all the things he did.
Tear Down This Myth is a great book, specifically about all the fantasies that people have about Ronald Reagan. I forget who wrote that.
Tear Down This what?
Myth, M-Y-T-H. Tear Down This Myth. You know, it's a play on Reagan saying to Gorbachev, tear down this wall. It's Tear Down This Myth.
Okay.
That's a very, very good book about the reality of the Reagan years. I wrote a book called Screwed, which talks about, you know, what Reagan did to us and the political consequences of it. And my most recent book, The Crash of 2016, covers fairly heavily Reaganomics, although it starts more with the philosophical background of it back in 71 when Lewis Powell wrote his famous memo, and then Richard Nixon later that year in 71 put him on the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court started paving the way for Reaganomics, as it were. But
the first book you wrote on that, what's the name of that?
Screwed.
How do you spell it?
S-C-R-E-W-E-D.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, right. Screwed.
Now,
and the subtitle is, you know, the Undeclared War on the American Middle Class.
Okay. About all your magazines are conservative. Do we have any liberal magazines?
Oh, yeah. There's some, you know, Mother Jones is a great liberal magazine. The Nation is a great liberal magazine.
Nation?
Yeah. The Nation, yeah. TheNation.com is their website. In These Times is a good one. And one of my favorites, I can never remember the title of it. They've got that list in the front on page 2 or 3. Lewis Lapham is the editor. Anyway, there's a bunch of them, Vernon. You shouldn't have a problem finding them.
So find it on the computer?
Pardon? Yeah, Harper's. Harper's is also, you can get all these online, or you can buy them in the newsstand. And if your newsstand doesn't carry them, you can ask them to, you know, or you can subscribe. Vernon, I got to move along, but thank you very much for the call. Great to hear from you. Earl in Colorado City, Colorado. Hey, Earl, what's up?
How are you doing, Tom?
Good. What's on your mind?
Okay. I watched the State of the Union. It's been a long time. We both know that. Mr. Obama had a lady on there that was living in her car. And we're still dealing with this long-term unemployment.
Right.
Well, I'm reading this. Republicans think we're all lazy and don't want to do this and that, but they don't live in our shoes. And then they go on a two-week break and leave us hanging.
Yeah.
And it's almost 4 months and it's a five-term thing. Is it a game with them or are they just mean people in general?
Both. Both. Here's the calculus that the Republicans are playing. A five-month extension to long-term unemployment, which would be retroactive back to the 3 days after Christmas last year when the Republicans cut off all the long-term unemployment for people, the federal long-term unemployment support. A five-month extension of that passed the Senate. It originally was going to be 6 months, but the Republicans said we'll only vote for it if it's 5 months, which basically would take us through, I think, the end of April, maybe the end of this month. That passed the Senate. And it's sitting in the House of Representatives, and it would pass the House of Representatives if John Boehner would allow it to be voted on. But he is refusing to bring it to the floor for a vote. And he's saying the only way he will do this is if President Obama will give him something for his billionaire donors. You know, the Koch brothers will make billions of dollars on the Keystone XL pipeline, so he wants that. Or, the Koch brothers would like a tax cut. So, Obama will give a tax cut to billionaires, then Boehner will bring this to the floor. And the president's saying, I'm not, cutting deals. This was passed by the Senate. It's right there in front of you in the House. You should let your members vote on it. And they would vote for it. So the one guy who is standing in the way of long-term unemployed people getting their unemployment compensation is John Boehner. And if you have any concerns about that, you should call his office and let them know what you think. Although, frankly, what I've discovered is that Republicans' offices, more often than not, you get an answering machine, whereas with Democrats, you get a human being. The other way to do that is to look on his website. You'll get the telephone numbers for his, which I think would be boehner.house.gov, and it's spelled Boehner like Boner, B-O-E-H-N-E-R. And you'll get the telephone numbers for the local offices in Ohio. And if you call the local offices in Ohio, odds are you will not get a machine. You'll get an actual person. And then say that again. Oh, speaker.gov. Okay. Yeah, it's because he's the big shot. He's the speaker. Okay. So anyhow, good luck with that, Earl. And let him, give him hell. John in Encino, New Mexico. Hey, John, you want to talk about Hillary and Warren?
All right. Yeah, I don't think it's a good idea for Elizabeth Warren to run with Hillary because I think it would neuter her too much. We need her to be the strong advocate she is.
I don't disagree, but again, let me, we've had this conversation many times. I'm not a big believer in the great man theory of history. I don't think that just because a politician holds a particular position, and Hillary, she was on the board of Walmart. She's always been kind of a moderate Democrat. I think that the times make the politician rather than the other way around. And Hillary at least knows how to use power, and she knows where the bodies are buried. And I'm of the opinion that if Hillary came to office during a time of genuine national emergency, and I think we are in one, and I think it's going to get a hell of a lot worse, that she has the potential. She's certainly not there now and never has been up to this point. But she has the potential to become a truly great president. I would much rather have Elizabeth Warren, given everything that's gone on so far. But Elizabeth Warren's only been in the Senate for, 2 years? Same as Barack Obama. And I think this is one of the big problems that Obama had when he became president, is he didn't have LBJ's background. He didn't know how to take names and kick ass. He didn't know how to use the power that he had. John, thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with me, and or with you, and with me on the line, is Sonali Kolhatkar, who is a host over at KPFK, host and producer of the program Uprising on KPFK Pacifica's morning drive time program. Uprisingradio.org/home is the email address. Sonali, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me on, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. First of all, tell us about your program.
Well, it's a daily radio program, much like yours, and we cover news that's important to ordinary people, news of the world, news about what our politicians are doing, but also environmental news, great ideas that ordinary activists are taking on, solutions to our problems. We look at issues like immigration and racism and gun rights. We look at issues like the strength of our democracy. We also look at international issues like war and militarism and climate change. So it's a very broad range. We love to have artists in studio to talk about their work and how they contribute to, you know, cultural issues and social ways of looking at things. It's a very broad range program, and the main idea is that conversations and dialogue between people can really strengthen our democracy by exposing us to new ideas.
That's, you know, well said, and you have a wonderful program. Uprisingradio.org is the website.
Likewise, Tom.
Well, bless you. Thank you. Now, I understand that you are trying to take your show or working on, not just you, there's a bunch of a group of people who are working on bringing your program to Free Speech TV. And in fact, you wrote this brilliant piece, Beyond Colbert, Why We Need Progressive People of Color on TV. Would you like to speak to those?
Yeah, you know, it's so important, I think, for us to see the kind of demographics on our television screen reflecting what we have in reality. And certainly we do have some diversity on our television shows, more so now than before. But what I would like to see is people presenting the news, not just on network television, where you have a little diversity, but on cable, and serious talk shows, on late night shows, where a lot of people get their news. I would like to see people be able to get their news from people they can relate to, not just politically, but also demographically, because those things are important. And, you know, of course, I was thrilled that Colbert is going to replace Letterman because of his politics as a progressive. That's very important to me. But at the same time, yet another white man. I mean, Arsenio Hall has been the only non-white male to ever host late-night television, and I believe there was a woman, one white woman. And so that's a stunning lack of diversity, and that's just not right in a day and age when we are seeing minority populations together in an aggregate sense slowly become the majority. In some cities like LA and New York, they are already the majority, and we need to see that reflected on television, particularly when it comes to political discussions, because it's the host, as you well know, who sets the tone, who sets the agenda for what to discuss.
Yeah, I'm with you. And how do we best do that in a way that's not gratuitous?
Well, exactly. It can't be tokenistic. It has to be smart people, and there's plenty of smart, amazing people out there. Melissa Harris-Perry is one of them, right? And we need to another person that I cited in my article is W. Kamau Bell, an amazing African-American comic and social critic. He had a show on FX. They moved it to FXX, and ratings dropped, and they took him off the air. We need to find smart people of color who have a lot to say, and there's plenty of them out there, and give them a chance and give them a microphone. Of course, our problem is we're not just dealing with sort of gatekeeper attitude when it comes to race, but money, right? We have this huge corporate-funded media structure. And for people, new people, to break into that structure, you need massive corporate backing. But we don't have that, those of us who are speaking truth to power. So we rely on things like crowdfunding, which is hugely challenging while you're also trying to produce and host a show that's a daily show.
Well, you have a project over at Indiegogo.com.
That's right, we do.
Your show.
We want to televise Uprising because Free Speech TV, the cable channel that also televises your wonderful program, approached us and said, we'd like to have Uprising on our channel. And so we looked around and said, well, we work at a radio station. We need TV equipment. We need cameras. We need a mixer, all of the hardware, but also the labor that goes into creating a video program out of a radio program. So we are asking the public who want to see not just greater diversity on the air, but also who like our program, who appreciate it and want it to be exposed to potentially millions more viewers around the world and the country to contribute to our campaign. We are just about halfway to our goal, but only 9 days left in the campaign. And really, you know, when we think about what this is to millionaires, this is pocket change to millionaires. We need $30,000 more, you know, pocket change to millionaires. Yeah. But if people give $10, $50, $75, $150, and lots of people give, it adds up really fast. It enables us to televise a show, and it also makes us more accountable to a plethora of people rather than a single benefactor. And that makes us more accountable, and it makes the whole project more democratic.
And we'll put a link over at tomhartman.com if there's not one already there. And, of course, uprisingradio.org. I'm assuming you have a link right out to your Indiegogo.
Right on the page.
Yeah, okay, of course. The one of the other issues, you were talking about money. And one of the other challenges that I think people who are people of color who are offering programming are facing is, and what brought this to mind is this decision from the Supreme Court today that, that Michigan has banned affirmative action, basically, and the Supreme Court said that's just fine. And, you know, I suppose in the best of all possible worlds, we would not consider race in any context. But the fact of the matter is that the average white family in the United States has wealth on the order of $80,000+. My numbers are a couple of years old, so they're probably off a bit. Whereas the average family of color in the United States has wealth of around $5,000. And there's this entire spectrum of issues that come out of that, from the ability to start a show and self-finance it to just a whole variety. Would you like to speak to that?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is a situation that is reflective of our overall wealth inequality. The kind of wealth inequality that exists today is unprecedented. And then if you look at communities of color, as is the case in so many indicators, you see a disproportionately large inequality. And of course, there's probably not even a handful of billionaires of color out there. So when we're talking about the gap between wealthy and poor, it's a very, very, very stark for people of color. And so this is really important. At the same time, as you have the Supreme Court justices, the majority of them imagining that they live in some kind of post-racial world, you have a situation where today the Koch brothers have adopted this Libre initiative to try to woo Latino voters. President Obama, his administration's leadership in the Department of Homeland Security is saying they're reconsidering their deportation policies. As usual, come election time, both parties want to pander to the Latino vote, and they are trying to do what they can. And slowly and slowly, over time, we're going to have a situation when those in power cannot ignore anymore the country's changing demographics. The TV is so far behind that I really hope we catch up to a fair representation and start changing the dialogue to speed up the process whereby policies actually match the need.
Yeah. Well, I wish you the very, very best. Uprisingradio.org is the website home. Of course, the Uprising program can be heard on KPFK, Pacifica's Morning Drive program. Sonali Kolhatkar, am I saying that right?
Kolhatkar, almost.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much, Tom.
You are doing such great work. And once again, people can contribute to this effort to get Sonali's show onto Free Speech TV on TV over at Indiegogo. uprisingradio.com, but you can find the link over on our website at uprisingradio.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my absolute pleasure, Tom. I hope to join you on FSTV in the coming months.
Me too. I hope someday we can meet as well.
Yes, I would love that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And once again, Sonali's website is uprisingradio.org. It's really worth checking out. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Kent on the line with us from Ion, Indiana. Is that right, Kent?
Ion in Indiana.
Okay.
Yes.
So what's up?
I'd like to share with your listeners a little letter I received from AT&T as far as my benefits were going.
You're a retiree?
Yes, I'm a retiree. And I worked there 43 years after I got out of the Marine Corps. Excuse me while I clear my throat. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, that always happens to me.
Quite all right.
But anyway, they sent me a little letter, and it says, "Dear Theodore and Sally, our records indicate you're on Medicare. As we previously communicated, AT&T is making arrangements for our Medicare-eligible retirees and Medicare-eligible dependents of our retirees to receive health benefits in a new way. You want to know what the new way is? They're dropping us."
Oh, so they're basically saying because you qualify for Medicare, they're not going to pick up the bill anymore.
No. They paid the I don't know whether you call it Medigap or what, but if that was.
They were filling in the hole for the Medicare Advantage or Medigap.
Neither one of them. They're dropping it. They're just dropping it, and then they're offering to get us their new way of helping us. I'll read it to you I'll be more precise. It says, "You will have access to more plan options as well as a new way to enroll in your 2015 health care coverage through the Aon Retiree Health Exchange." Well, I called them, and they're a bunch of insurance brokers. So what, in effect, what they're doing is they're helping me pay for everything myself. So.
Right.
I just thought top it off, when I worked there, like most of the people that they're affecting are World War II vets, Korean vets such as myself, Vietnam, and these guys, they were told when they were working there, every year they gave us a benefits guide and told us this was part of our benefits.
Right.
And then this young fella, I don't know what his name is, that CEO, he's about, I don't know how old, but he's never served a day in his life in the service or anything. He doesn't know what that's like. He snaps his finger, and all of a sudden we lose this, something that we've been counting on for a long time.
Yeah.
And I think that was a very sneaky play that they made. And they never, it indicates that they told us beforehand. That is not true. Maybe they slipped it in with one of my bills or something.
I guarantee it.
Yeah, but yeah. They didn't tell me anything, and I just thought maybe the general public ought to know what a billionaire company does to their ex-employees, who most of them served their time in the military.
Yeah.
And
well, you served your time at AT&T. I mean that should be. Damn it! Enough. You're. If you were represented by a union, then I guarantee you, whether you were or not, that those benefits, those retirement benefits you got, didn't just fall out of the sky. They were the consequence of taking less of a pay increase, and having that money be put into a pension fund or a retirement health fund instead. And to have that money be taken away is just a crime. Kent, thanks for sharing your story. I'm sorry to hear it. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on the place where smart people get their news. And John in San Jose, you want to talk about the Green Party. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Just fine.
Okay. I'm out here today at the San Jose State University Green Earth Day event.
Mm-hmm.
It runs from 10 to 3 today. And I'm at the Green, I'm not currently at the Green Party table because I had to run away from the drums in order to hear you. I'm inside a building right now, but, basically we're promoting our candidates for statewide office, Louis J. Rodriguez for governor, Ellen Brown for treasurer, Laura Wells for controller, and David Curtis for secretary of state. But also I wanted to add that as a former Peace and Freedom Party member, I generally support the, what I call a two-party system in California, which I call the Peace and Freedom and the Green Party.
Right. Is this a primary, John, that you're talking about?
It's a primary for June 3rd ballot.
Yeah, and this is the top two primary. So.
Yeah, it's the top two system now, so that unfortunately only the top two get onto the November ballot.
Yeah, but my friend Marianne Williamson is running for Henry Waxman's old seat against, you know, some establishment Democrats in this top two thing.
Yeah.
And how's the top two, for people who don't know what we're talking about, California changed their system. So you don't have a Democratic primary and a Republican primary and a Green Party primary. You know, basically, everybody gets thrown into the pot, and whoever the top two people are, that's who gets to run against each other in the general election. And
yeah.
What consequence has that had on the Green Party and other tertiary parties, other parties that are not part of the top two, you know, the Republicans or Democrats?
Well, it improves things a little bit because everyone can vote for whatever they want to in the primary.
Right.
It used to be you could only vote for your own party in the primary, but now under the top two system, you can at least vote for whatever candidate you want to in the primary,
right,
even if you're not registered with that party.
Right.
But unfortunately, it does cut out the lesser candidates in the general election.
Yeah.
But I wanted to add, though, there is one. The rest of my comments are my own personal comments, not related to the position of the Green Party.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to shout out about Cindy Sheehan because she's a candidate for governor on the Peace and Freedom ticket in California.
Oh, really?
And yeah.
Wow, I haven't seen Cindy since she and I were standing out front of George Bush's house in Houston with a bullhorn yelling "war criminal" at him. That was about 3 years ago.
She thinks that she has a chance of coming in top two because she came in second against Nancy Pelosi in San Francisco a couple of years ago.
Wow.
Something like 17% of the vote.
Wow. Yeah, she did.
So if she gets second against Governor Brown, then she may have a fight on her hands in November.
That'll be very, very interesting. Okay. Well, John, yeah, thanks for the heads up. Thanks for the tip, and thanks for the thoughts on how top two is working in California. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Chris in Seattle. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Tom, what's going on? So this is actually a line that libertarians use all the time. But coming from progressive, I still think it's really important to remind people that our federal government, or we the people that we elect to, you know, to run our democracy, as it were, is still an incredibly large producer of pollution. I mean, you got like depleted uranium. I mean, you talk about this, levels in Iraq. I mean, like off the charts birth rate. I mean, like in Libya, we're you know, bombing the man-made rivers over there. You know, the FDA is pushing things like GMOs and, you know, saying factory farming is fine, like genetically modified meats. What are some things that we can do as progressives instead of libertarians just saying, like, well, the Koch brothers, you know, they like to go off and, like, you guys complain about them producing a bunch of pollution. Well, look at your government. You're always defending our government. And I don't think that we are, but what are some, you know, things that just average working people can do to help encourage, you know, we the people in our government to, you know, have less of a, you know, global, you know, footprint in terms of pollution.
Right. Well, here's I'll give you the problem and then the solution. The problem, Chris, is that the majority of Americans do think that we should do something about global warming, although they're not as alarmed about that as they might be about other issues, tragically. But there's a whole lot of things that the average Americans, that the majority of Americans want, that they are not getting out of Washington, D.C. There is this fascinating study that came out of Princeton 2 weeks ago showing that what the top 10% want, what the top 1% want, they get. What the bottom 50% or the bottom 10% want, they never get. So we really no longer have a democracy in the United States. We have an oligarchy. Our form of government has become almost entirely oligarchic over the last 35 years. That's the bad news. The good news is that there's a simple cause to this. And the simple cause to this, the cancer at the core of this, is that the Supreme Court has allowed money – to come into our political system in a virtually unlimited fashion. And so those people with virtually unlimited money are able to manipulate our political system to their advantage and to their ends. And so if that's the cancer that's at the core of our republic, and then that's the cancer that needs to be removed. And that was put there by the Supreme Court progressively over a period of 100 and some odd years, but very aggressively since 1976, the Buckley decision, First National Bank in 77, and then the Citizens United in 2010. The only way that I know of, I know there are some kind of convoluted ways to get it out, but the most straightforward, simple way to get this out is, and it won't actually change anything tomorrow, but what it does is tomorrow, if it's passed tomorrow, it allows us to then make the changes, because right now the Supreme Court's actively blocking us. And that is to amend the Constitution to say money is not protected by the First Amendment, it's not speech, and corporations are not protected by the 14th Amendment. Lincoln didn't fight the Civil War to protect the corporations, free the corporations. The 14th Amendment's about human beings. And that simple amendment to the Constitution can be done. And the best organization working on that right now is movetoamend.org. And so if you want to get involved, go to that website.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So let me add, I have no affiliation with the group at all. I just am in awe of the work they're doing. MoveToAmend.org. Also, Progressive Democrats of America, good. PDAmerica.org. Bad and the very, very gemaliparously ugly. Brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, ecowine.com. The good, Sean Sheely. The progressive activist has announced that this September he will host an event called Bundy Fest right outside the home of Fox News' favorite Nevada rancher, Cliven Bundy. Since Bundy himself has decided that rules and laws aren't important, Sheely says that Bundy Fest will be an anything-goes kind of festival, sort of like Burning Man.
After the conclusion of Burning Man, we're going to begin Bundy Fest. That's 240 bands playing all night and all day, 24 hours a day, at the protest zone here right across from beautiful scenic Bundy Ranch in Bunkersville, Nevada. Now, some people have asked me, where will we camp, where will we park, anywhere, really, it's fair.
Beep that. Stop that. Oh, my. Hit the beep. My sincere apologies. I had no idea that was built into that SOT. My apologies. Okay, anyhow, whether he's serious or just trolling, Sean Sheely is right in pointing out the silliness behind the whole Bundy Ranch controversy. So let's hope, well, once again, I'm blithering. The Bad, the Boy Scouts of America. On Monday, the organization has revoked the charter of Seattle's Troop 98 after it refused to kick out its openly gay leader, Jeff McGrath. Although the Boy Scouts started allowing gay scouts last year, the organization still prevents gay men to serve in any leadership roles whatsoever. McGrath, for his point, is staying defiant and refusing to step down. He says he'll remain at his post despite the revocation. Boy Scouts is supposedly an organization that teaches young men how to be honorable members of society. It's becoming increasingly clear that it's failing to teach these young men the most important value anyone can have, tolerance. And the very, very ugly, the White Genocide Project. The white supremacist group is under fire today after some of its supporters apparently left Easter eggs containing hateful messages around a quiet Virginia neighborhood. Easter eggs were then, of course, discovered by local children whose parents were rightfully horrified. Here's a clip. Have we listened to this one in advance? Okay, this is from a local newscast. Okay, here's a clip from a local news report about the incident.
The Smiths were having an egg hunt with their three-year-old son, an Easter Sunday tradition interrupted after an upsetting discovery.
My husband noticed the last Easter egg, and I knew that wasn't one of the ones I'd put out. He picked it up, and we opened it, and it's got the white supremacist stuff in it.
Inside the egg was the message, "Diversity is white genocide," saying, quote, "Mass immigration and forced assimilation of non-whites into our lands is genocide."
That's just very, very awful. That's incredible. Whew. Again, I want to say it one more time. I'm really sorry. We played a clip that had been sent to us from the TV show. I'm sure that they will beep it for the TV show, but nobody had warned us that it had a bad word in it, and we were in a hurry. We're down a person here right now. Jim's on vacation this week, and we played it without previewing it, which we almost never do. And my apologies. Don in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Don, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was calling to comment on the capital gains comment you made earlier about how the capitalists like to use the risk of their money as the reasoning behind their lower top tax rate. And I wanted to just bring up the point of, you know, I'm a union tradesman. I'm an electrician. And I put my body and my health at risk every single day when I go out there to collect my paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's just, I mean, you can't compare the two risks. I mean, how many people die every day from investing their money? Probably not a single one.
Yeah.
But
unless they die from inactivity, from sloth, you know.
Or from suicide because they made a bad investment, but that's probably their greed that caused the bad investment. And,
yeah.
But the point is, every day someone dies on a construction site, and they don't they don't consider that to be a risk.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and that's why I say, you know, our tax code is upside down. It's backwards. We are offering a lower tax rate to people who make their money sitting around the pool on their butts waiting for the dividend check to arrive. And people like yourself who work and, you know, an electrician, you literally are putting your life on the line every day. People like yourself who work can face up to a 39% income tax rate. And people like Mitt Romney who invest for a living, have a maximum 20% tax rate. And they have so many loopholes drilled in their income that they can make millions and millions of dollars and pay no taxes at all, as Mitt Romney has done in the past. So, Don, thanks for the call.
Can I make a comment about the unions, about
sure.
the paycheck fairness?
Yeah.
So paycheck fairness, you mentioned in the news thing while I was listening on over the phone, and the union has transparency with the wages. I know what the guy standing next to me makes. We don't have to be secretive about it.
Yeah.
It's in our contract what we make and how much we make and how we get our raises, and that's all transparent. And another time, I just would like to know how you feel about Bitcoin, talking about capital gains and how the IRS has considered it. Assets and you pay capital gains on it now. And what do you think about that?
About
thanks
what?
For taking my call.
What being capital
Bitcoin,
gains?
Bitcoin, as the IRS come out and said it late in March, they
the coin
assess it as assets.
Oh, bitcoins. Don, I don't have a clue. I got to tell you, my opinion of bitcoins is that they are the Dutch tulip bulb of our era. They are they're a scam. Or something close to it. I would stay as far away from them as possible. And if the government is going to try and tax them somehow, I guess what they're saying basically is that they're wealth rather than income, that they're an asset rather than a money. It's almost necessary that they do that, because if they had said that income, bitcoins could be income, well, art can be an asset, right, that you pay capital gains on. But that doesn't mean that you can go to the store and buy something with art. Once they acknowledge that it's income, then they're acknowledging that Bitcoin is a legitimate currency. And no, to the best of my knowledge, no government on earth is acknowledging that Bitcoin is a legitimate currency. And, you know, for good reason. There's no government behind it. There's no we the people anywhere involved. So, Don, thanks for the call. Those are my thoughts on that. Jared in Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Jared.
Tom, thank you very much. There's an article, full page ad in the New York Times today, Nuclear Matters. This is similar to the one that was the first part of the month they also put in, talking about all the wonders, talking about zero free emissions, carbon free energy. I would be interested in your take. How can they say, when they haven't figured out what to do with nuclear waste, how can they say that it's free? it baffles me. And I would hope that when the president is dealing with Japan and Prime Minister Abe, who is contemplating opening I don't know how many new plants in Japan, it is.
Yeah, I don't think they're building any new ones, but they've got 50 some odd ones there that were running before Fukushima, and they've turned on several of them, and they're talking about turning on the rest of them.
But we in the United States are building, you know, two new ones.
Two new ones down in Georgia.
I think it's more than two.
You may well be right.
Even if it's two, it's too much.
Yeah.
Until we solve what to do with nuke waste. And one last thing, which has bothered me a lot, all of our capital ships and a good many, I think all of our submarines and perhaps more, are powered by nuke.
Mm-hmm.
What does the Navy do with nuke waste?
It's a good question. I don't know. I don't know the answer.
All right. Well, maybe it's a non-question. But yeah, anyway, yeah. I thought that today's ad coming out on Earth Day was, I think, points to the oblivious of the nuke industry.
Yeah. Well, or it's a greenwashing attempt. You know, they're trying to make everything trying to make themselves seem green. So, anyway. Benjamin, watching Free Speech TV in East Carondelet, Illinois. Hey, Benjamin.
Carondelet. Yeah. Close enough, Tom. How you doing?
Good. What's up?
I just wanted to make a comment, and it's not really relevant to anything you've been talking about today, but I've been doing a little bit of independent research on the history of the Republican Party, and I've been especially interested in how you moved from the Republicans. I don't necessarily want to say that they were positioned on the left in the early 20th century and into the middle part of that century. But there was definitely a progressive element to it.
There was a very large progressive strain in the Republican Party at the turn of the century. Yeah.
Right. But you go back even further and you look to the period around the Civil War and you can find actual Marxists involved in the origin of the Republican Party.
Yes. They were called the Radical Republicans.
Not even like
Samuel
radical,
Chase.
I'm thinking of this group that has been labeled the Red Republicans. And they haven't gotten a lot of publicity, but there was a senator named Carl Schurz in Missouri. And the International Working Men's Association, I think it was called, Karl Marx's group.
Right.
Charles Sumner, the senator from Missouri, actually became a dues-paying member of that group.
Wow. That's one part of American history that I really need to bone up on. I need to learn a little bit more. Benjamin, thank you for the call and the heads up.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It was the Radical Republicans who were opposed to slavery, who, you know, got the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments passed, and who basically vanished around 1880. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Paul, listening to KBCS in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, how are you today?
I'm fine, Tom. Thanks for asking. I wanted to comment on the Supreme Court decision, today's decision.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to say so, or maybe not, but I don't think we can blame the court on this one. I think we need to lay the responsibility, such as it is, squarely on the shoulders of the people of the state of Michigan.
Yeah. Well, and let's just back up a little bit here, Paul. It started out the University of Michigan was using race as one of many criteria that they were evaluating, and they were giving a slight preference to people of color in their entrance. There was a white guy or a woman, I forget which, who sued.
A woman from Saline, Michigan.
Yeah, a woman from Saline, Michigan. Thank you.
Trying to get into the law school.
Yeah, who sued and said, "Wait a minute, I had a disadvantage because I'm white, and that's wrong." And so the good citizens of the state of Michigan. Now, was this a referendum or was it the legislature?
As far as I understand it, an amendment to the Michigan Constitution.
Right. They amended the Constitution to say that race cannot be considered when, you know, for college admissions or pretty much anything else.
Right. And the way the court had to look at this was they had to look at another case, and they didn't fool with the Bakke case from 1977, University of California Regents versus Bakke, which was a guy who was trying to get into the medical school there, and the University of California at Davis had set aside 16 positions for African Americans. What the court ruled then, and they didn't change their ruling here, was that race may be used as a factor, but not quotas. And they cited the 14th Amendment and Title VI of the 1965 Civil Rights Act.
Right. And so, here all they did was say, well, a state can decide that race is not a factor.
With their state universities, correct. Right. And so other states still may use race as a factor.
That's correct.
But this is what I'm saying. This is what I'm saying is the body politic in Michigan, and Tom, both of us are native Michiganians, has changed really in a disturbing and unsophisticated way.
Mm-hmm.
The kinds of policies that are going on there, and you have to look at it this way. The state of Michigan in the last 20-some years, 20-plus years since the Republicans have taken over the state, has lost two representatives in Congress. Basically, anybody with a progressive mind has gotten out of there, including you and me.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
who's left, you know?
Yeah. Well, and this goes back to my theory about economics and politics. Michigan had arguably one of the strongest high school graduate middle class working class
right.
amalgams in the entire United States because of the auto industry, and that got wiped out. And so Michigan went far more quickly than most other states from the working class being the middle class to the working class being the working poor.
Yes.
And that sets people up to look for scapegoats. And the Republicans were very happy to step up and say, oh, here's the scapegoats. It's people of color. It's liberals.
Yeah.
It's college-educated people. It's government employees. And, hey, you know, they got Fox News behind them.
Yeah, you're absolutely right on. Just recently, a study of the, since they're taking all kinds of, I don't know who can afford to go to college in Michigan anyway, since they've cut taxes, all the tuitions have gone up, but they've taken money out of the K-12 system. Now, fourth graders in Michigan are the ranked last in the nation in basic math skills.
Yeah, it's really sad. Hopefully, the end of the story is the end of the story of the J curve, you know, where those diverge enough that people revolt. But we'll see. Paul, thank you for the call. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in with Victoria Jones at the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Ellen Ratner's charity that operates in South Sudan does such great work. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on today?
So you are talking about the Supreme Court's decision on the Michigan affirmative action ban.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously you already know the decision. It upheld Michigan's ban on racial preferences in university admissions. So I won't go into the details of that. But you might find interesting Justice Sonia Sotomayor's scathing dissent, which she read from the bench the first time she's read a dissent from the bench. Couple of things she said. She quoted from something that Chief Justice John Roberts said in a 2007 case that's frequently quoted, where he said the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. She quoted that line in her dissent and described it as out of touch with reality.
Right.
He filed a brief responding to her. She also said the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to speak openly and candidly on the subject of race and to apply the Constitution with eyes open to the unfortunate effects of centuries of racial discrimination.
Wow. That's strong stuff.
Yeah, it was a very, very strong.
I mean, this is, you know, when Shane was describing the decision to me this morning in some detail, my only comment was, you know, it's crystal clear. It's totally right. However, it's absent of any context or history. And as soon as you apply the context and history, it becomes wrong. You know, it's,
yes. Well, so it went on. As members of the judiciary tasked with intervening to carry out the guarantee of equal protection, we ought not sit back and wish away rather than confront the racial inequality that exists in our society. It is this view that works harm by perpetuating the facile notion that what makes race matter is acknowledging the simple truth that race does matter.
Wow. That's so well said. And it is a facile truth. I mean, it's remarkable.
Yes.
So what else is going on?
Well, the Supreme Court also appeared skeptical today, both of the Ohio political speech law and assertions that an anti-abortion group cannot challenge it. This is a case I know you were going to be following closely. I don't know whether you talked about this one also.
My understanding is that today's arguments were mostly roughly the equivalent of standing kind of arguments. Do I have that wrong?
Yes, they were. They are. It's a question of whether they have standing. I mean, they talked a little bit about free speech, but it is. It's a question of whether they have standing to sue, and if they have standing to sue, they've said that they will go forward and sue. So that's really what that case is going to be about.
So what happens? Does that mean that there will be a decision about standing, and then it'll be rescheduled for the next calendar on the court, the next time around?
I think if they decide on the standing, then the Susan B. Anthony list will go forward and sue, and I think it'll start in the lower court.
So it gets tossed back down to the lower court?
Yes.
Assuming the Supreme Court says, yeah, you can do this. Otherwise, it doesn't.
They say you can go forward, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Interesting.
But they did talk about lying as well. I mean, they did say that this three-person panel of the Ohio Commission, if it finds probable cause that the groupment about this...
I'm losing your phone, Victoria, if you can hear me. I've lost your phone altogether.
Okay.
Oh, there you are.
I'm here?
Yes, you're back.
Okay, well, I've turned my volume up.
Thank you.
Which would you prefer?
No, this is fine. Whatever you're doing is just fine. Keep going. No. You need to put your phone back up to your ear because I was hearing you through your phone. Victoria? I think, yeah. Yeah. No, she's not. She's not on the board. Okay.
Okay, I'm back.
All right, and I've got you back on the air.
Yeah, I'm back.
My apologies. So you were saying?
Justice Elena Kagan did say that the decision that if this Ohio Commission found probable cause that a group statement about this representative was false, that decision alone could lead voters to think that they were lying. She said, voters think probable cause means you probably lied.
Right.
So there was some discussion of free speech and the rush of doing things during an election campaign, but it is ultimately going to be about standing.
Yeah, yeah. And my guess would be that if this decision ever arrives at the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court is asked the question, does the government get to decide what's a lie and what's not, they're going to say that's not the job of government.
I think you could be right.
Yeah.
Think you could be right.
And I can, you know, I could argue either side of that. I mean, you know, there are some cases like this one here where it's fairly obvious, you know, that this was a lie and I think most people would want government to point that out. But on the other hand, there are others where it's gray areas and one person's lie is another person's truth and you know the whole thing.
Yes.
Yeah. So
the federal agency that investigates chemical accidents, that's the U.S. Chemical Safety Board, said today that the deadly blast at West Fertilizer Company in Texas was preventable and called on regularly to take additional steps to reduce the risk of another catastrophe.
Wow.
It said that state and federal regulators should restrict the amount of ammonium nitrate stored at any one time, and said that no other single chemical has caused more widespread harm in preventable accidents than ammonium nitrate.
Yeah, this is the same stuff Tim McVeigh used in his bomb in Oklahoma City. Now, wasn't West Chemical storing this stuff in violation of federal law or state law, or at least not notifying anybody of it?
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah, which raises a whole another issue here. Okay, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goesfortheoldgood.com. Victoria, always wonderful to see your smiling face and hear your voice. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, oh, she's on Skype. She's not, I don't have to push a button here. Julia Ho is on the line with us. She is a student and activist at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. The website is studentsagainstpeabody.org. And the Twitter, WU Stop Peabody, WU as in Washington University, Stop Peabody. And Julia, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Tell us about what's going on at Washington University in St. Louis.
Yeah, so we're currently in day 15 of a sustained sit-in organized by students here to basically demand that the university cut ties with Peabody Energy, which is the largest coal corporation in the world and also sits on our board of trustees.
Wow. The largest coal company in the world, and one of their officers or members or owners sits on your board?
The CEO.
Wow. So 15 days is a long time to be sitting in. How's that working?
Yeah, so it's been a really, really long journey. It's been, students here are very, very dedicated to making this happen. I think we've made it very clear to the university that we're not leaving until our demands are met. We've been in sustained negotiations with the administration since last Saturday, and actually just about 2 hours ago got a public statement from the university.
What was that statement?
So I won't go into too much detail, but basically, through our negotiations, we've been asking for a lot of different things. One, that most of all, that the university come out and take a public stance on Peabody Energy. And so now, almost 15 days in, it's very clear that they're not willing to do that. So their public statement was basically very much a watered-down version of our demands. They said that they would, do things like create a symposium on corporate social responsibility, but nothing in there does it say a lot of the times they went back on their original demands, saying that they would do things like go on community tours to extraction sites across the country. Mm-hmm. And that was the one thing that students are really concerned about.
Right. In other words, you want the members of the university management, shall we say, to actually see the kind of damage that this energy company is doing, and they're unwilling to do that.
Exactly. So what was sort of shocking to a lot of students today is that the university in the past few days has been willing to, go to community tours and has expressed a concern for a lot of the issues we brought up. But today in their public statement, they've gone back on all of those negotiations. They've basically taken, five steps back from where we thought we were and made it very clear that they're, not willing to take a stance. And despite the fact that they, claim to care about things like public health, the environment, social justice, and corporate social responsibility, Peabody's money is speaking a lot louder than the students, the faculty, and alumni who are in support of us.
Yeah, welcome to America. I mean, this is, we saw this study that came out a couple of weeks ago from, I believe it was Princeton, that showed that, the top 10% get what they want politically almost always, and from 50% below get what they want almost never. Has anybody produced a good, documentary? I mean, if you're not going to be able to get the trustees to go to see the damage Peabody is doing, can you bring a sight of the damage that Peabody is doing to them? Are there any good documentaries that show what Peabody is up to?
Yeah, so we don't have From what I know, there aren't any that specifically target Peabody. However, we have done a wonderful job here of creating our own media, so I would suggest anybody who wants to learn more about these issues should visit our website. We not only have articles there, but we actually just put up a video that we made in collaboration with the residents of Black Mesa today about a poem that one of our students wrote sort of in solidarity with that community, as well as a lot of images and different things from that community who is resisting Peabody's expansion into their reservation.
Now, the website is studentsagainstpeabody.org. Do I have
yes.
that right? Okay. Now, I don't think most Americans associate St. Louis, Missouri, kind of the middle of the country, with, big coal. People think of West Virginia when they think of coal.
Yeah, I think that's...
How did this happen? How is the biggest coal company, you said, in the world? How are they headquartered in St. Louis? What do they do out of there? Is it privately or publicly held? What's the situation?
Yeah, so Peabody is the largest private sector coal corporation in the world. And I think a lot of the way that they're able to sort of cover up their public image is really by laundering their reputation through universities as well as through a lot of other public institutions here. So they give money to our science center. They give money to us for clean coal research. They give money to UMSL, one of the other schools here. They give money to even the zoo, the opera house here. Everything here is funded by Peabody. And so most people here, they see the name all the time, but they don't realize the effects that Peabody has in places all over the country and all over the world. And part of that is because St. Louis is so far removed from a lot of these extraction sites.
Now, do you mean that Peabody is the largest coal company in the world or the largest privately held
coal corporation in the world?
Privately held corporation. So it's a family-owned operation, basically.
One would hope so.
Privately held typically means that their stock is not for sale on the New York Stock Exchange. Is or any other stock exchange. Is Peabody's stock tradable?
Yes, I think it is.
So it's divestible.
Yes, exactly. And so I think that, for us, the sit-in, although we haven't gotten the things that we wanted, has made it very clear sort of the extent to which the university has ties with Peabody Energy. And not just Peabody, we have, I think it's very important to recognize that we have a lot of other corporate interests on our board. We have executives from Monsanto, executives from Arch Coal, another really large coal corporation.
On the board of the university?
Yes, here at Washington University.
Oh, that's amazing. That's amazing. But it's not surprising. I mean, this is happening all over the country, isn't it? Are you hearing from colleagues in other universities?
Yeah, so we've gotten a wonderful flow of support from a lot of people across the country. And what we're really hoping from this is that we're tackling not just the issue of the relationship between Peabody and WashU, but really getting at this much deeper issue of the relationships between corporations and the fact that they are using universities to launder their reputation. And so there have been a lot of students from all over Missouri who have come out and support us. There have been other schools across the country who have sort of said that they're inspired by what we're doing. And we're hoping that this sit-in will really inspire and have a spark towards an escalation in the divestment movement.
This is great. We're talking with Julia Ho. She's with Washington University and the website studentsagainstpeabody.org. And the Twitter is WU, as in Washington University, Stop Peabody. Peabody is Peabody, as it sounds. Julia, this whole issue of name and shame and coming out, has, in terms of blowback, have you yet heard the old canard from the university that, well, gee, if we get rid of this corporation, your tuition's going to go up?
Yeah, well, I think that it's very clear. The university itself hasn't come out and said that. I think a lot of students have expressed that concern. But to us, we don't think that those things are mutually exclusive. We don't think that funding our university should come at the expense of degrading the environment and of displacing people from their homes and of ruining public health. So to be truthful, the university is not transparent about how much money they receive total or where it goes. But we are pretty certain that a big chunk of that money is going towards quote unquote clean coal research here. And so we think that, if it's a loss to that research, if that money were being put into renewable energy, real renewable energy, then our money would be better spent and we would be, it would be an economic success for us as well.
Yeah. It's worth noting, before Reagan came into office, students paid about 20% of the cost of tuition. Now students pay about 80% of the cost of tuition. It used to be governments, paid 80%. Now governments pay about 20%, and you get a little help from corporations. It's, you know, Reaganomics has just devastated our, you know, sorry to sound like an old man, but when I was your age, I knew nobody was student debt. And this is just so wrong that corporations have so insulated themselves into these universities. And obviously they're using money as a way to do it. Julia Ho, you're brilliant. You're just brilliant. Thank you so much for dropping by.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great talking with you. Julia Ho, studentsagainstpeabody.org. Get over there. Check it out. Give them some help.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It is so marvelous to see young people standing up, waking up, standing up, and doing something. 15 days in this setup, in this sit-in, excuse me. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I watched, you a good bit, but I've been thinking about this pipeline. Mm-hmm. And what we're going to do about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, with all the flooding that we have in North Dakota, South Dakota every spring, why not take this pipeline and use it to divert water to the desert areas of the country and put it to a good use?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even the Ogallala Aquifer is not going to last forever. It could even be used in the Midwest. It'd be kind of hard to get it over the Rockies over to Arizona, but...
Well, I don't know. I think that if you diverted it, if they can figure out a way to run nasty oil from Canada to the Gulf and then dump all the waste in the Gulf, they could figure out a way to get this stuff, get the pipe, which do we have possession of the pipe now?
No. No. What's happened is this Canadian company, TransCanada, it's their pipe, but it's the land is being taken through eminent domain. Pardon?
It's on American soil now, isn't it?
It is, and the dirt underneath it. Well, actually, I'm not even sure. I don't know all the legalities of how they're doing it. What I find so bizarre, though, is that it's the way that it's promoted in the media is American energy from American sources. Well, yeah, Canada's part of North America, but that still is adding to our trade deficit. It's a foreign country. And by the way, did you see where Canada now has the middle class of Canada now has more income and more wealth in the middle class of the United States for the first time in history?
Yeah, and they don't want to run the pipe across their country.
No.
Yeah.
No, they have banned it.
Yes. No. But also, in Move to Amend, we've got to start sending, like Tom Clancy said, teachers and engineers, not lawyers, to Congress. Farmers.
Yeah.
Send people who own small farms.
Yeah.
And get our country back.
Well, and Move to Amend is doing a marvelous job of creating these small groups all over the country. They've got several hundred of them, I think over 500 of them, where people are literally in their living rooms or their kitchens. They're getting together with other folks and not just holding their local politicians accountable, but educating people. If every one of us could just wake up four or five other people, we would have such a move. And in fact, we already have such a movement. I mean, Move to Amend has come so far.
I try to teach, but I don't know if I'm making any kind of effect or not. I tell people never live anywhere where you can't grow some of your own food.
Yeah.
By the way, there's a shortage of truck drivers, so don't expect the trucks to show up with your food. Learn to grow it yourself.
Yeah, yeah, that's very good advice.
Okay, well, thanks, Tom.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call, Norm. It's great to hear from you. How much time do we have to the break? 30 seconds. So that's not fair to put somebody on for 30 seconds. Netflix, by the way, this is a fascinating headline from today's Financial Times. Netflix has traded barbs with Comcast over the cable company's $40 billion takeover of Time Warner Cable in a sign of potential hurdles in the path of a deal that faces scrutiny from antitrust authorities. Matthew Garahan, writing in Los Angeles. It's a shame that it takes a multi-billion-dollar company to take on a multi-billion-dollar company to do what's right for average working people and small businesses. But it could be that Netflix... We respectfully think it is not in the public interest to have one company control a majority of U.S. residential internet. Netflix representative told Financial Times, our view is that the best remedy is to block the merger. You think? And, of course, you will not see or hear a peep about this on MSNBC, which is owned by Comcast, which is tragic. 20 minutes past the hour. place where despair is not an option. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. And Rachel in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, Rachel, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Rachel.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Sure. What's up?
I'm just greeting from the Red Estate in the Union. Thank you.
Okay.
I was actually calling about the caller you had on earlier, the interview with you had that you have with the guy who wanted to carry his gun into Starbucks and, you know, wherever.
Yeah.
And he said that he was doing it to, he was doing everything he could to protect himself and his family. And I thought to myself, okay, that was absolutely hilarious, because if that's the truth, then this guy should also be probably dressed head to toe in neon pink spandex and learn martial arts.
Right. Go dressed as a ninja.
Exactly. I mean, otherwise, really, really, I think at the end of the day, if you're really trying to do everything to protect yourself by carrying a weapon into Starbucks.
Yeah.
I think at the end of the day, what you can call yourself is a premeditating ground stander.
Yeah. Well, I think there's some sort of fundamental, and I don't want to speak of our guest. I mean, he's not here to defend himself. But in general, these guys, like the guys who show up at the Bundy Ranch, you know, and position themselves on the highway overhead and were literally pointing guns at federal officials. It just amazed me. I mean, can you imagine? I think it was Timothy Egan wrote a piece about this for the New York Times yesterday, the day before, where he said, "Can you imagine if there was a vendor?" Now here in D.C., we've got these food trucks, you know, these food truck vendors. In fact, I bought a little Ethiopian, a thing of Yemisir Watt this morning, and I put it on a salad from a food truck vendor. He says, imagine one of those food truck vendors has, like, parked their truck on the mall. The mall is that big stretch of grass that goes from Lincoln Memorial down all the way down to the Congress. He's parked a truck on the mall. He's been there for 20 years, refusing to pay any kind of fees. He's dumping his waste on the ground. Not that there's a fee that they pay, I think it's just, but if he's up on the grass, right? And it's browning out the grass and it's ruining the mall. And do you really, and let's imagine that it was the Ethiopian food truck. And so his skin was dark. Can you imagine the Tea Party showing up with guns to protect this guy? I can't.
Not in a million years.
And it's the same thing. It's the same
exactly.
thing. You know, and Egan says, he says, what's the difference? Well, it's a white guy with a Stetson hat and a horse. And somehow, you know, America has this romance with white guys with Stetson hats and horses. And that is
somehow when they threaten to throw their women in front of them and we run.
Yeah. Yeah. It's absolutely bizarre. It's absolutely bizarre. It's why we started the smallpenisgunclub.com or .net, I guess it is. Because I think that there's a psychological issue going on here. I think that there's something wrong with these guys, but I won't ask you to comment on that. Rachel, thank you for your call and excellent comments. I appreciate it. Dan in Aurora, Colorado. Hey, Dan, thanks for listening to AM 760. What's on your mind?
Yeah. I was just calling to respond to something you said last Friday.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about congressional salaries being tied to minimum wage.
Right, yeah. If we simply said, you know, when we reset the minimum wage, that congressional salaries would be, I haven't done the math. I really need to sit down with a calculator.
Well, I have done the math.
Okay, great.
I am running for Colorado CD4.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a hard haul.
Good on you.
I have to first petition on by write-in.
Uh-huh.
I have to get on write-in. But basically, if you raise the minimum wage to $11,
right.
Working on a 2,000-hour year,
right.
50 weeks at 40 hours a week, Congress would make about exactly what it's making now, about $176,000, if you made it 8 times the minimum wage.
Oh, it's that simple.
Yes, it's that simple. And there'd be no more of this automatic raises unless they vote against it. It would be, if you want to raise, help the least in our country.
Right, right.
And I also have a plan that the income tax will be tied to the minimum wage also. So if the wealthy want a tax break, raise the minimum wage, tax break.
Huh. So you'd have an inverse relationship between the top tax rate and the minimum wage.
Exactly.
Instead of, if the top tax rate was 100%, the minimum wage would be $10. If the top tax rate becomes 90%, the minimum wage becomes $11. If it's
80%. Actually, it would be tied to in the plan that I've kind of laid out. I mean, of course, you know, it may not be the final plan, but you know, you need to present something, and we need to start presenting something to the people.
Right.
But the top rate is at 100 million hours, and then it's based on the minimum wage times that.
So you're basing it on a minimum wage hour equivalent, because really, is there anybody in this country who is so brilliant that what they're doing is 1,000 times smarter or more competent than anybody else?
Well, that's the scary thing. That the top rate that I had put out is at 100 million hours, as that's what your work equivalent would be in the year. And there are still people making well beyond that.
Wow.
That ends up at being $1.1 billion. Last year, David Tepper, hedge fund manager,
right,
made $3.5 billion.
Right, and I'll bet he made a lot of it as carried interest, which means he paid a maximum 20% income tax on it. And this is, again, why we needed to do away with this carried interest capital gains thing.
Sure. And here's a question for you. If David Tepper clocked in at 8 o'clock on January 1st, it's a holiday, he'd take that off, on January 2nd, in order to make what the average family in America makes, what time would he clock out?
I don't know.
8:01 and 47 seconds.
So in a minute and 47 seconds, this guy made what the average family in America makes in a year.
In a year, exactly.
And how can anybody justify that?
I don't know.
It's a scam.
Yeah, and that's my whole thing. That's why I'm running. I listened to you, Tom, and you said get involved.
Dan, is there a website for what you're doing?
I just put in my papers end of last week, and so I will have hopefully a website up by the end of this week.
Call me back when you do, okay?
Absolutely. I'll do that, Tom.
We'll give you a plug. Dan, thanks a lot for listening to AM760, and good on you for having the courage to run for political office. You're stronger than I am.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I guess the word I was looking for is braver. Braver than I am. Good luck, Dan. Yeah. 28 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Netflix now coming out against the Comcast merger. Very, very interesting. We'll see where this goes. I mean, what we're looking at here is oligarchy in the United States. There's no other way to describe it. You know, our Democratic Republic, it's not dead, but it's on life support. And only an amendment to the Constitution to say that these five white guys, four white guys and Clarence Thomas, that these five old men on the Supreme Court are wrong. That money is not protected by the First Amendment. George Washington did not have three horses shot out from underneath him in the Revolutionary War to protect billionaires. And people say, oh, George Washington, a rich guy, he had a plantation and slaves. He died broke. Oh, Thomas Jefferson, rich guy. No, he died broke. These guys were the upper middle class of their day. The really rich people, like the Johnson family, who owned a giant castle up on the Hudson River during the Revolutionary War. They had 300 European slaves. You know, basically it looked like they weren't even slaves. They were employees, but they were dressed like, you know, Knights of the Round Table kind of thing. They were the real rich people. They fled this country. The Johnson family went up to Canada. Others went back to England. We didn't have the first person worth $1 million in today's money, which is not all that much money, really, until the 1790s. So George Washington did not fight the Revolutionary War on behalf of the First Amendment so that money could be protected by the First Amendment. It didn't happen. By the way, I used a quote last week, and thank you, Sue, for reminding me of this. Here's this quote. I attributed it to Thomas Jefferson, and it's conceivable But if it is, it's not in the – I have the collected writings of Thomas Jefferson, and I went – Sue pointed this out to me 6 months or a year ago, and I went and looked, and then, you know, sometimes your brain isn't quite as sticky as you want. But this quote – I'm not sure who said this. Part of this I know he said. He said, you know, he was talking about until the bulk of society is reduced to mere automatons of misery to have no sensibilities left but sinner and suffering, then begins indeed the bella omnium in omnia, which some of philosophers observe to be so general in this world, having mistaken it for the natural instead of the abusive state of man. He was actually talking about public debt and taxes. So this, you know, this is an argument that I'm surprised conservatives don't make more often. But this beginning, those seeking profits, were they given total freedom, would not be the ones to trust to keep government pure and our rights secure. Indeed, it has always been those seeking wealth who were the source of corruption in government. And I had attributed this to this 1816 letter to Samuel Kershaval, and it's not in there. So if you know where it is, or if you know who said this, or where it came from, I would love to find out. Because I published that back in 2004, and I'm not sure where I got it from now. Although I think back in 2004, I was sourcing pretty much everything out of my original 20 volumes, and then I had an electronic version of it. But I can't find it now. So if you have any ideas, let me know. Anyhow, Isaiah in Chicago, listening on CPT. Hey, Isaiah, what's up?
Going on, Tom. Considering the gap between the Republican turnout and the Democratic turnout in midterm and off-year elections, what historically has happened to create and contribute to the Democratic deficit? Well, in other words, why do more Republicans show up more faithfully than Democrats do? And the second part to that is what can be done and how it could be done to close this gap.
Okay. Well, the answer to the first question is I'm not sure that you're assertion is entirely accurate. You get lower turnout on both sides, and there is a lower turnout on the Democratic side than the Republican side, relatively speaking. But it may be that more total Democrats show up. I mean, keep in mind, the House of Representatives, 1.4 more million people voted for Democrats in the House of Representatives in the last election than voted for Republicans. Yet Republicans control the House of Representatives. So you can't discount the impact of gerrymandering, of the Republicans having rigged the districts, particularly with the census of 2000 and 2010. They had this down to an art form. And this is one of the reasons why the Koch brothers and others put so much money into state governments so that they could gerrymander those districts and thus then control the federal government. But number one, the first reason why people don't show up and Democrats don't so much show up, number one, is that, you know, the elections don't get as much publicity. The king, the president, is not on the top of the ticket. They are not perceived as being all that important. And number two, the other reason why Republicans might be more likely to turn up than Democrats is that our election days are Tuesdays. Now, some states have expanded this and made it, you know, more widely available and more easily available. And Oregon's even gone to the point of all, you know, vote by mail. And they don't see as much of a drop during the midterm elections as other states do. But increasingly, Republican states are trying to dial it back to you got to show up on Tuesday. Republicans are more likely to have the kind of wealth, the kind of job, the kind of income where they can take the day off and it's no big deal, and they live in a district where they only have to wait 15 minutes to vote. Democrats are more likely to be working people, and they have a hard time taking that Tuesday off. They really need to have the weekend to vote. I believe it was Scott Walker, but in several states now they've done away with Sunday voting, for example, because the African-American churches were doing the souls to the polls thing, you know, go to church and then afterwards take a bus to the precinct. And the Republicans put the kibosh on that. And so I think that, you know, we need to have a national holiday for voting, or we need to move our voting to weekends. There's so many things that we could do to make voting easier and more accessible. And instead, we're doing the exact opposite. And then, of course, we need to get these stinking machines out of the way. But am I answering your question, Isaiah?
Yeah, you are answering the question, and I hadn't thought about gerrymandering and the redistricting at first. Because,
yeah, it's a big one. It's a big one. And that's why any year that ends with a zero, it's really important that state government be in control of Democrats because the Republicans will gerrymander it so that never again will, you know, you have Democrats have any authority there. And they really did that in 2010. They poured tons and tons of money in to get out the votes so that, because the districts are redrawn as a consequence of the census that's done the year later. So in 2011, they did the census, and in 2012, the districts were redrawn. And now we've got this, you know, gerrymandered mess. Isaiah, thanks a lot for the call. And thanks for listening to WCPT. Sebastian in Santa Barbara, listening on KPFK. Hey, Sebastian, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Listen, as it is right now, votes, the best votes are with your dollars. So I looked on your website, and I was just wondering if there's anything you advocate us boycotting, in other words, not spending our dollars on, because that seems to be what companies really listen to the most. And also, real quick, why not run for office? I mean, seems like we have 50 senators like you. There'd be a whole lot of changes happening.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I wouldn't be a decent politician. I lack those, you know, I'm not an outgoing, gregarious extrovert. I'm an introvert who knows how to pretend he's an extrovert. I can sit here all alone with a camera and a microphone. But you put me in a room with 50 people, and I am very uncomfortable. So I'm not a politician. Number one. Number two, what was the other question?
Would you advocate us boycotting?
Oh, boycotts. That's right. Number two, I am not a big fan of boycotts. You know, the only effect that boycotts have, boycotts typically don't hurt customers or companies. Rather, what they do is they shame them. They don't economically hurt them. So the idea that your most important vote is your dollar is actually a flawed idea. It actually plays into the idea that those with more dollars have more votes. And that's antithetical to democracy. That's the opposite of democracy. So,
but isn't that how it is now? I mean, it's probably not the way.
It very much is. But see, we live in an era of monopoly. I mean, try and buy something. I remember I've used this example a million times, but back in the early 2000s, Louise and I were living in Vermont. I needed to buy, you know, we moved in a new house. I needed to buy some new pillows. And the only store within 150 miles that sold pillows was Walmart. And so for the first time in a decade, I walked into a Walmart store. I mean, it's like the monopoly has gotten so great that it's really, really difficult to mount an effective boycott, much less have one. Now, the divestment movement could have some juice. And this is particularly working at the state level and the university level, where you've got large state pension funds and large university endowments. And students are saying, get rid of your carbon-based investments. But for an individual, I mean, if you had a bunch of stock in ExxonMobil, say you got $10,000 worth of stock in ExxonMobil and you sell it, it doesn't hurt ExxonMobil at all. You're just selling it to some other guy who's got $10,000. It doesn't, you know, not a penny of that goes to or from ExxonMobil. So, or, you know, you say you're going to stop buying ExxonMobil products. You're going to start shopping at the no-name gas station down the street. Well, guess what? In all probability, ExxonMobil refined their oil, or the Koch brothers did. It's, you know, we are kind of stuck in the system now.
What's one that where they didn't refine their oil? Tell us that. I'll buy that gas.
Well, the point is that we need to get off gas. You know, we need to get off the grid. We need to start putting solar up. We need to the extent possible, we need to extract ourselves from this toxic economy rather than trying to change it. I think it's so corrupt and so vulnerable to crash, which is the essence of my book, The Crash of 2016. I think it is so corrupt and so vulnerable to crash that it is going to die of its own weight. And what we need to do is get ready for that and get the hell out of the way. So I don't have any specific suggestions for boycotts. Sebastian, thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And Sebastian, you're listening to KPFK. Sonali Kolhatkar was on earlier. Go to uprisingradio.org and help out. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Carla in San Bernardino, California. Hey, Carla, what's up?
Hey, you know, I was listening to you, I think it was Friday, when you were talking about 10 years ago the Koch brothers had 1 million, and 10 years later now they have over 100 billion, or 1 billion, now they have 100 billion.
Yeah.
And how you were talking about there was a Jefferson had written. I couldn't quote you exactly for what it was.
Yeah, well, what Jefferson actually wrote, he said, "I'm not among those who fear the people. They and not the rich are our dependents for continued freedom." And then he talked about, you know, the bulk of society and all that kind of thing. The phrase that is not in there is, "Those seeking profits where they're given total freedom would not be the ones to trust government to keep pure and our rights secure." And that's not in the Kirchhoff letter, and that's what I'm still looking for. Anyhow, back to you, Carla.
Well, first of all, your show is so truthful and very eye-opening, and I just want to congratulate you and your staff.
Thank you.
And
when we get it wrong, we try to get it right, which is why I'm looking for
exactly.
this quote.
Do you think the bottom line is Koch is versing the federal government, that their objective, like a chess game, is to knock down our federal government so they could then put their hands in every other thing that's open?
Oh, of course. I mean, this is the essence of my book, Screwed and the Crash of 2016. If these guys can bring about this libertarian paradise where the federal government basically does nothing other than operate the police, the army, and the court system, and everything else is gone, what that means is that everything else is still necessary. It's still important. We still need education. We still need health care. We still need roads. We still need the commons. We need all these things. But they now come into private hands. And so they now become opportunities for profit. And that's the end game of these guys. They want to take over the functions of government so that they can make a buck off it, A, and B, so that they own us, essentially. I mean, what we're talking about here is good old-fashioned feudalism, as in European feudalism, as in 17th, 16th, 14th, 13th, 12th century European feudalism. That's the end game of these guys. And that's really what, you know, libertarians think they're all high and mighty because they're, you know, I call them Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid, you know, because they're you know, they think the prostitution should be decriminalized and pot should be decriminalized. Big
so
whoop.
They're in total denial. Right?
Yeah, big whoop. But really, what if you look at their policies are the policies of you know, King Richard V.
And last thing, these elderly men that are in that are federal judges right now,
right.
How do we as a nation rid them without them having to pass?
It's almost impossible. The, you know, one of the things that came out of the Powell memo was the Federalist Society. More than half of our federal judges now are members of the Federalist Society. This is basically a right-wing club. And it's, you know, it's damn near impossible. You just have to wait for them to pass or to retire and hope that you have a Democrat in the White House who can put some decent people in, because there's so many Bush appointees and Reagan appointees. And this is one of the reasons why, by the way, why the Republicans are constantly filibustering judicial appointees, is because they keep hoping that they can just wait until a Republican becomes president, and then they can put more Judge Bork-type right-wingers in. Carla, thank you for the call. Politics does matter, is the bottom line. Even politics is distasteful. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and Michael in Dublin, Virginia. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Tom, you know, there are two kinds of people in the world. There are those that get it and those that don't. And most people don't get it. Thomas Jefferson said that we can be free or ignorant, but we can't be both. If we look at the story, like the story of the hare and the tortoise, you know, the hare got so cocky that he thought he was so fast that he could take a break and just sit down, relax. And then what crept up on him was the tortoise. But what we have today, everybody's arguing, well, what kind of hare was it and what kind of tortoise was it? And they miss the point. They just don't get it. But if we did this, if we look at each other and we say, well, with our eyes, we might be able to see. With our ears, we might be able to hear. And with our heart, we may be able to get the sense of it, but most Americans don't open up a book. They don't read. They're too busy looking at their sports games, being entertained by the media, and they're into all these other things that they don't see what's going on.
Yeah, I'm with you, Michael. And one of the my principal job, what I view as my job, is to help people see what's going on, is to wake people up. And hopefully not just, hey, wake up, but hey, wake up in a way that will cause people to want to wake up five other people And that's how movements start. And I'm doing my best here. I know you are too. And good on you for it. Thank you for the call and your kind words. You're absolutely right. Dwayne in Shelton, Washington, listening on our Pacifica affiliate there, KBCS. Hey, Dwayne, what's up?
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I'm calling in regards to what I just heard about the way you mentioned the people at the Bundy Ranch in Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
It just sounded like that there was a bunch of people there with sniper rifles. Wish it were over the overpass, but you keep forgetting to mention that it was actually the BLM people that had sniper rifles first at the Bundy family, and had other armed BLM agents there first, and were intimidating the family and tasering them and had their German Shepherds on them, that type of thing.
After 20 years of ignoring federal court orders?
Yes, there's a lot more to that, but yes. So if you don't pay your taxes for
20 years and the sheriff shows up to evict you, then you think it's just fine if a bunch of your friends come over and point rifles at the sheriff?
Not at all.
Well, isn't that essentially what happened?
No. What should have happened is they should have showed up and put a lien against his house and that type of thing. There's court ways to do them, not show up with weapons drawn at the family saying, we're essentially going to steal your stuff now.
Yeah, well, that was out on public land. They didn't go on his property. What they did was they took his cattle off public land. He and his family went out onto a public road to confront those officers. You know,
yeah, but they had sniper rifles pointed at their family on their property.
No, it wasn't on their property.
They had sniper rifles pointed at their family.
No, it was not on their property, and the sniper rifles
were
being pointed at federal officers.
There's federal officers with sniper rifles pointed at these people. They had unarmed people at the time.
Dwayne, why do you care?
Because I don't want them doing this to other people.
So you are of the opinion that if people refuse to pay their taxes for 20 years and they squat on federal lands illegally for 20 years, that the federal government should do what?
Well, then the sheriff actually should come along and take care of that.
Isn't that what happened?
No. What happened was these federal agents came along and started pointing weapons at everybody. Everybody came too close, they tasered them. And also, you know, put up free speech zones and all this other.
This was all out on public property, Dwayne. This was on the public road out in front of the ranch. Nobody went on the ranch.
No, but they had sniper rifles up on the hills pointed at their house.
There were people pointing sniper rifles at the federal agents.
After the fact.
During the fact.
You're missing the... No, before the fact, you have the BLM agents were there. Had him up on the ridgeline.
Dwayne, I can't believe that you're defending a deadbeat.
What I'm against is federal agents.
You're against federal agents having guns, apparently.
I'm against federal agents coming in pointing weapons at people for no reason. They were not being hostile.
There is. Wait a minute. There was a reason. 20 years of illegal trespass and not paying taxes.
So then put a lien against their house, that type of scenario, not sit there and point weapons and have automatic weapons pointed at these people.
This was all about moving cattle off federal land. They were removing these people's cattle. They were squatting on 66,000 acres of federal land. The BLM showed up to move.
They're allowing their cattle to graze on the land.
On federal land.
Grazing rights. Well, it should have.
They did not have grazing rights.
Because the only reason they got it is because of these turtles, which the federal agency is actually slaughtering.
They did not have grazing rights.
They had grazing rights since the 1800s.
No, they bought this ranch in 1948.
So you're saying that their family line from 18 was 1870, which is all.
They moved from Arizona in 1948. It turns out, and fact check me on this. Dwayne,
okay,
you'll find that what I'm telling you is true, that they bought this ranch in 1948. This is a recent purchase. And, the whole thing is a scam, Dwayne. You've got Fox News trying to get you all whipped up. And I'm telling you, it's just, you know, it's Sean Hannity trying to get ratings and get more advertising dollars. And it's sad that you're playing the part of the useful idiot. Anyhow, we'll be back tomorrow. thank you for being with us today. And don't forget, democracy does start with you. And let's try and get some of the money out of this whole republic thing. Check out movetoamend.org or pdamerica.org. Get out there and do something. Tag your it. I'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.